My counsel is setting up. I'll ask our marshal to call the next case.
Next case is A18-1775, Richard Duncan, the laborer, this is County of Chisago, respondent.
Again, today we have counsel that's familiar with appellate procedure, so I will not proceed with instructions on how to create our record. When you're ready, Mr. Tanek, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Marshall Tanek. I represent the relator in this proceeding, Richard Duncan. He's the former sheriff of Chisago County. As the court is aware, this case concerns one issue, and the issue is whether ex-Sheriff Duncan is entitled to a defense and indemnification in connection with a civil lawsuit brought against him and the county. The claim here is brought under Minnesota Statute 46607, Subdivision 1, which provides for defense and indemnification of municipal and governmental and county employees under certain circumstances. Sheriff Duncan maintains that Sheriff Duncan sought indemnification, defense and indemnification shortly after the lawsuit was brought against him and the county in federal court. The county denied his request for defense and indemnification, and that brings us here today. The issue before this court is whether the county is obligated to defend and indemnify the former sheriff for actions that took place during the time he was sheriff and have now led to a civil lawsuit in federal court. The lawsuit is a claim by a former colleague, subordinate of Sheriff Duncan, in the Chisago County Sheriff's Department. She maintains in the federal court lawsuit three claims, a claim of sexual discrimination, hostile workplace, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Claims are made against both the county and Sheriff Duncan. The case arises out of some rather unusual circumstances, a series of communications, most of them social media communications, emails and texts between Sheriff Duncan and the woman who worked with him in the Sheriff's Department. Those communications were anonymous at the time. Subsequently, Sheriff Duncan acknowledged that he was the author of these anonymous communications, which were entitled Control, which were issued under the name of Control Freak. The communications were sent supposedly to Sheriff Duncan, although he was the author, and in which he tried to enlist and encourage his co-worker, whose name is Michelle Jacobson, to join him at a work-related conference in Bemidji. And over a course of several days,
the first communication request that they go away for three or four nights to Bemidji to stay at a hotel together, it didn't say anything about a work conference. He that later then stated that he would try and find a work conference for them to go to, but I think the record shows that the original communication from Control Freak was that requesting that they go away for three or four nights to Bemidji.
Yes, that's true. And there ultimately was a conference in Bemidji, and that was what was intended to be the reason for going away together. But you're right, Your Honor. That was the initial communication.
And the emails that he sent to the employee were through his private email, correct?
I think they were through his private email. They were done in the workplace. Then they had communications and discussions about those emails and the whole series of communications at work. So most of the communications they had were discussions about this incident or about these communications that took place in the workplace. The emails themselves.
Because it was at work, what you're saying is at work translates to scope of employment?
It's certainly a major factor in scope of employment. The statute requires for indemnification that the allegations against the employee be done in connection with the performance of his or her job duties, which essentially is translated into scope and duty of employment. So there's a number of factors that the courts look to determine whether the behavior occurred in connection with work-related activities. Most of them here are satisfied. The bulk of the community.
How does sending a threatening letter asking someone to go to a hotel together that's not connected with any work conference when it's originally sent. How is that in the performance of the duties of the position, given that Minnesota Statute 387.03 specifically defines the duties of a sheriff?
Well, the duties of the sheriff include interacting with his staff and engaging in law enforcement-related activities. It was asserted by the sheriff in these communications and in the communications he had with Ms. Jacobson that this control freak was engaging them, trying to threaten them, trying to extort them. That kind of activity is activity that sheriffs and sheriffs' job duties require them to look into and investigate. Notwithstanding
the
fact,
he was the one who sent the threatening letters.
Well, he was.
How can the person who sends the threatening letter justify that as being in the performance of his duties?
Well, it's with
in fact, I think the record also shows that he instructed the employee not to discuss this with anyone else and said he wouldn't discuss it with anyone else. So clearly, he didn't view this as something within his job duties if he couldn't discuss it with, wasn't going to discuss it with his colleagues.
Well, the activities took place, as I indicate, in the work setting. They were communications between employees. They were geared towards, although not initially, but they were geared to going to this conference in Bemidji. The discussions, the communications took place on work-related, not only in the workplace, but on work-related time as well. So the thrust of these communications and the thrust of this behavior was work-related.
But simply because it's at work doesn't, how does that fall within his statutory duties? Because again, the statute provides that he has to be acting in the performance of his duties, and I didn't see in the brief an argument tying it to the statute itself, which defines the sheriff's duties.
Well, the case law has interpreted that terminology for the statute of defense and indemnification to be equivalent to scope and course of duties. And in deciding a scope and course of duties case, the court looks to a number of factors, including whether they arose in the workplace. We're not maintaining that simply because these communications occurred at work in the workplace. That alone satisfies the statute, but it's a significant factor in determining whether the activity or behavior took place in connection with the scope and duties of the job that Sheriff Duncan was occupying. Indeed,
the cases that you are referencing and that you cited to in your brief, are there any cases that apply that standard to the standard in 466.07? I didn't see that in the cases that you cited.
Those cases were not 466. Some of the cases were 466.07 cases, some weren't. But I think the overlap is clearly there because the scope, in the plaintiff's complaint in this lawsuit, in the federal court complaint, which is the underlying basis for our action today, the plaintiff claims that these activities were work-related. The plaintiff is claiming that these activities took place within the scope and course of the sheriff's duties. So the allegations that we're seeking defense and indemnification for are allegations that the claimant says were work-related. And I think that's another significant factor in determining the scope of the county's obligation here to defend and indemnify Sheriff Duncan. We are certainly not by any means condoning the behavior. That's not the issue here. The issue is whether Sheriff Duncan is entitled to a defense and to be indemnified for the allegations asserted against him. And insofar as the plaintiff herself in the underlying case is asserting that this was work-related behavior, that is a factor that I think should and can trigger a statutory obligation for performing within the scope and course of the duties of the sheriff. Now, that was one of the reasons, not the only reason, why the county denied indemnification. The county also denied indemnification under the subdivisions of that statute that require that, or that they're actually phrases exceptions. If the activities took place in the scope within the performance of duties, as we maintain they did, then defense and indemnification is obligatory unless one of the exceptions apply. We maintain that the activity here, for purposes of this case, requires defense and indemnification, and we've cited some insurance cases that have some analogies here as well.
Do you agree, Mr. Tanick, that as a certiorari appeal of the county board's decision here, that we're to look at this order and determine whether it was arbitrary, oppressive, unreasonable, fraudulent, or under an erroneous theory of law, or without any evidence to support it? Is that the standard we're to judge this by?
Yeah, that's the standard of review for a certiorari proceeding. We maintain that two of those prongs are satisfied here. We maintain the decision was arbitrary and capricious for reasons I'll mention in a moment. We also maintain that the decision to deny defense and indemnification also was under an erroneous theory of law.
Okay, defense of indemnification, you've argued or submitted your argument in connection with the scope of his employment. What about the finding, the second prong, that he acted in bad faith and that
right.
determination by the county? I mean, you have to have both. You have to be able to demonstrate both.
Right. Well, the bad faith is the exception. If the action took place within the performance of his duties, then defense indemnification is obligatory unless one of the exceptions apply.
How can he admitted the conduct? I have a real gap in trying to figure out if you admit to the bad conduct, how that doesn't, in fact, show that you acted in bad faith.
Well, in order for there to be bad faith, there has to be some kind of malicious behavior. In this case, what was submitted to the county was an undisputed report by his mental health professional, a psychologist, that was not disputed. And the record is undisputed that Sheriff Duncan was operating under PTSD. He had post-traumatic stress disorder, and his psychologist linked his behavior to that affliction. That was not contested. It was not disputed.
Well, counsel, the county considered that, and in our review, we must uphold the county's decision if it's explained how it derived its conclusion and it's reasonable on the basis of the record. I think the county's order shows that it considered that report, and the doctor's report actually is very conclusory as to PTSD and its effects on Mr. Duncan. I don't think it explains in any detail how PTSD could have caused this specific conduct.
Well, Sheriff Duncan is.
Doesn't the record support the city's decision given the deferential standard in that regard?
Well, we maintain it doesn't because the county did not address whether Sheriff Duncan was operating under a medical or mental defect or deficiency. It essentially ignored what his doctor had said. They didn't make any, the county board did not make any determination that whether he was or was not under a mental deficiency. They had before it information, evidence from his doctor, which was undisputed in the record, that his behavior was actuated as a product of PTSD. He explained some of the incidents that underlie the PTSD, and his doctor also noted that this is a syndrome that is engaged in by many law enforcement individuals. He said this is not uncommon in law enforcement. In fact, we have a statute now in Minnesota that went into effect recently that provides that if there is PTSD and diagnosed for a law enforcement professional, it is presumed to be occupationally related. And that's Minnesota Statute 176.011, Subdivision 5E. So there was information before the county board that Sheriff Duncan's behavior, which again we're not condoning by any means, but it was explained as being a product of post-traumatic stress disorder. The county chose to ignore that, even though it was undisputed in the record. That constitutes an arbitrary and capricious decision in our view. Furthermore, the county's decision was based upon an erroneous legal theory, which also invokes certiorari reversal, because the theory upon which the county proceeded in denying defense and indemnification to Sheriff Duncan was ignored the fact that he had a diagnosis of PTSD. And the case law that we've cited is legion. It usually comes up in connection with insurance issues, but not always, that PTSD can negate or eviscerate any claim of intentional misconduct or negate any bad faith. by virtue, in this case, we have an undisputed diagnosis of PTSD. That can constitute a defense or negate any bad faith or intentional or malicious wrongdoing. The county did not take that into account in making its decision.
Now, is there any evidence that the county had been made aware of his PTSD symptoms prior to this series of incidents that brings us here?
No, he wasn't either, which is true of a lot of PTSD. The individuals afflicted by it often doesn't know that they have it, and it's not determined until a diagnosis is conducted later. The county was well aware of the PTSD diagnosis at the time it made its decision, because Sheriff Duncan, I on behalf of Sheriff Duncan, submitted the psychologist's report to the county. So it was aware at the time of the decision that he had PTSD diagnosis. But no one was aware prior to that because he hadn't been diagnosed.
Thank you, Mr. Tanick.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Diane Ebert, and I'm here on behalf of the County of Chisago. I want to start out by telling you that I think that the statement or the issue that we're here today is not whether or not Mr. Duncan is entitled to defense and indemnification, but whether or not the county board's decision made with regard to that issue should be upheld by this court, because this is a petition for certiorari review. That means that the standard of review is much more limited than in a case where you would be asked whether or not the evidence, whether you'd be weighing that evidence yourself. The case law is very clear that this is a quasi-judicial decision that was made by the county board. It's subject to a very limited and non-intrusive standard of review. The real question is simply whether or not there was reasonable support for the county board's decision. And I would submit to you that based on the record that was developed with regard to this matter, it clearly was. Minnesota statute section 466.07 essentially has a two-pronged analysis, as had already been pointed out. The first one, the individual must be found to have been acting in the performance of the duties of the position. Now, Relator has argued that the case law associated with scope scope of duty, specifically was raised for the first time in his reply brief, and he cites to a case that's dealing with the concept of respondeat superior, somehow carries through to this analysis under the Subdivision 1 prong of Minnesota Statute 466.07. I would submit to your honors that analysis is simply untrue. The Dakota County case that we've cited it's the case of Simpson v. Backstrom, specifically said that analysis is not appropriate in a 466.07 context. In fact, the court specifically declined to include that analysis, saying that the only thing that's relevant under a 466.07 analysis is whether or not the employee was acting, and they said, as in taking some action or engaging in some conduct in the performance of the duties of the position, as in while fulfilling some requirement and expectation of the position, in this case, of sheriff. There is absolutely nothing in the record to support a conclusion other than what was reached by the county board here, that Mr. Duncan's actions, taken with regard to this employee in the sheriff's office, was anything other than outside those duties of the position. Minnesota Statute 387.03 establishes the duties. And just by way of sort of paraphrasing, it's to keep and preserve the peace of the county, pursue and apprehend felons, execute service of process, attend to the needs of the district court, investigate accidents. And to be clear, none of these job duties include coming up with some elaborate scheme to convince an employee to go off with them to a hotel room for 3 days, creating written communications from an anonymous person who he identifies as control freak and threatening an employee. The duties don't include discouraging a person from actually seeking the assistance of law enforcement. In fact, these actions by relator are the antithesis of what we expect a law enforcement officer and a sheriff in particular to do in the state of Minnesota. Now, there's been some arguments advanced here that because the communications took place, I think it was at the workplace is the way it was referred to. Well, let me point out to you that that is actually not true. While Sheriff Duncan may have been at the workplace, the bulk of the communications with the employee in this instance occurred while she was away from the workplace on a personal trip to North Dakota. The email communications, the text messages, all of that was done while she was on vacation or using her personal time off. The very limited communications that took place in the office essentially included the initial reference to the alleged communication and then a quick admonition, we're not going to talk about this in the office anymore. Again, that evidence demonstrates that the sheriff was taking great lengths to separate himself from the workplace in these communications. They used personal email accounts to exchange the information. They had text communications, all the things that would not be within the confines of the workplace. So to suggest...
Appellant argued that plaintiff asserted that the conduct took place in the work environment in her federal action, and therefore this conduct could be considered to be within the performance of Mr. Duncan's duties. Could you respond to that argument?
Sure. What those allegations are with regard to the employee making that in the federal district court doesn't impact the analysis that's employed by the county board in this instance. The county board took into account the fact-finding mission that had already been undertaken by the investigator retained by the county. They invited Mr. Duncan to appear at the hearing that they were holding back in October to present his side of the circumstance. They did the research. They reviewed all the materials, and that's what they based their decision on. Yes, the complaint does include that allegation, but that's not determinative, and it certainly doesn't dictate what the county board has to do with the facts that are presented to it in a quasi-judicial proceeding where they are supposed to investigate, use that investigation, and apply it to the facts of the case. So that is not a determinative. That's absolutely true that allegation is made in the complaint, but that doesn't dictate how the county board should respond or has to respond. If that were the case, there would be no reason to have this fact-finding mission by the county board. Their hands would be tied. They'd have to do whatever the underlying case suggested.
And it's the statute itself that defines the duties of the sheriff, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you
so we should look to the statute in determining whether Mr. Duncan's conduct was in the performance of his duties.
Yes. This is not a circumstance where you have to look to a job description of some sort because it is dictated by the statute that exists, and that tells us an elected sheriff in the state of Minnesota, what their duties are in Minnesota. I want to address just briefly this claim that the county somehow disregarded the medical opinion that was issued by Dr. Eichenfeld.
That was a part of the documents that were reviewed by the county, weren't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely it was, Your Honor. If you look at the materials, and I'm sorry, I don't have the site directly, but it was tab 12 of the county board packet that evening, and it included specifically the documents that were provided for consideration.
A letter from the doctor to Mr. Tanning.
That's correct. And this comes up in context of both, I think, the arguments that have been advanced that this activity was in the performance of the duties, and it's also used later to sort of try to undermine the determinations that were made by the county board of malfeasance, wrongful act, and bad faith. And I should probably stop at this point and just remind the court that you have to have two. You have to have both of these things to be satisfied. I believe that Judge Werke pointed that out in one of her questions. If he's not acting in the performance of his duties when he engaged in the behavior, your analysis stops there. You don't even have to look to the next prong of the statute. In this particular instance, the county board considered the entire statute, and they did make a decision that he was not acting in the performance of his duties. So in theory, they could have stopped there and not gone on. But what they also did is they did an assessment of the actual behaviors, looking at it from the perspective of the exceptions, so that even if he is found to be within the performance of the duties of the position, they say the exceptions, malfeasance, bad faith, wrongful acts, that those also exist in this circumstance. I believe it was already pointed out, but what we have here is we have an admission by the relator that, yes, he and he alone are responsible for these behaviors, for these communications. That behavior in and of itself demonstrates bad faith. There can be no possible explanation that can be offered for him to believe that this was something that he had a right to do, he had the authority to do, that it was in his best interest or the employee's best interest that he engage in these behaviors. And the report from Dr. Eichenfeld does not undermine that determination. First of all, the report, as has already been pointed out, is very conclusory. There's no analysis as to how the alleged PTSD diagnosis caused this behavior. And contrary to what counsel argued, Dr. Eichenfeld's letter does not talk about the frequency of PTSD affliction on police officers or those in law enforcement. That particular argument has been stricken by this court because it wasn't something that was advanced by Dr. Eichenfeld before the county board below. Further, Dr. Eichenfeld's report isn't given any greater weight or doesn't have to be deferred to, and it doesn't really matter that it was technically uncontroverted, meaning that the county didn't somehow produce some medical expert to say quite the opposite. First of all, this is not a court proceeding in that the county would have some sort of right to have Mr. Duncan evaluated by a professional and render an opinion of their own, the sort of standard Rule 35 that we go through litigation. This is a proceeding by which the county board is asked to make a decision under the statute whether or not an individual engaged in malfeasance, bad faith, or misconduct. That's not akin to a court proceeding. And so to suggest that somehow simply submitting a report from a doctor is enough to render those conclusions meaningless just doesn't make any sense when you consider the context of the proceedings and how this process works. But furthermore, even in standard litigation practice, an expert opinion isn't entitled to any more credibility than another witness. The finder of fact is entitled to weigh and balance and decide whether or not an individual's statements, whatever they are given credence in their evaluation. And it's clear from the board's decision in this case that despite the existence of the report, which nobody disputes was there, they nevertheless believe that Mr. Duncan was engaged in malfeasance, misconduct, and bad faith for all of the reasons that are detailed in their findings. There's been some reference to whether or not there has to be some sort of affirmation by the county board in their findings that they are completely disregarding Dr. Eichenfeld's report. And I would submit to you that the case law that was relied upon by relator just simply doesn't apply in this case. The first case that's cited is a child support case, the Ramsey County versus Grew decision. And in that particular matter, the specific form was recognized by the statute. There's nothing in the proceedings under a 466 analysis case that says that a letter, a conclusory letter, with no analysis, has to be given deference by the county board. And then the second case that was cited is an unemployment case where there's a specific statutory requirement that says if an administrative law judge is finding credibility to be an issue, the findings have to note that. Well, that statutory provision certainly doesn't apply in this circumstance. And I think it's pretty clear from the decision that was rendered and the resolution that was adopted by the county board that the county board did not, in this instance, give credence to Dr. Eichenfeld's opinions. Furthermore, that's exactly what the job of the county board was to do, was to weigh those evidentiary facts and reach a decision. And upon review, it's this court's job not to substitute the judgment, your judgment, for that of the county board, but to confirm or to assure yourselves that the record supports the decision that was reached and that it wasn't arbitrary and capricious. And in this particular instance, I would submit to you that the record is very clear that that obligation is satisfied. Mr. Duncan had the opportunity to come to that hearing, and I don't want that to be lost on this panel. He had the opportunity to come there, to state his case, to provide whatever information he wanted the county board to consider, and he chose not to. He can't now come back and complain that somehow his evidence was not being given proper credence by the county board. We'd ask that you affirm the decision and dismiss the writ. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ebert. Mr. Tanik, you have the last word on the argument.
Just a couple of comments regarding the Dr. Eichenfield report. I was questioned about whether it was conclusory or not, and counsel mentioned it was conclusory. Of course it's conclusory. Any medical opinion is always conclusory. But Dr. Eichenfield did state that the gentleman, based upon his treatment of him, based upon his familiarity with post-traumatic stress disorder, and a particular type of methodology that he applied here, led him to conclude that this activity or action was a product of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, counsel, actually, the doctor said it seemed to be attributable. So he didn't conclude it was, he just said it seemed to be. And the doctor's letter is a page and a half at best. So it's not a detailed analysis.
Well, I don't know that we need I don't know that we measure whether there was post-traumatic stress disorder by the length of the letter. He could have written a 10-page letter and said the same thing. The point is, he submitted that. It was submitted to the county board. It was in their packet as tab 12. The fact it was in their packet doesn't mean they considered it because
they noted it in the resolution, though, didn't they?
They didn't address whether there was PTSD or not. They didn't make a determination. They noted it exists. I mean, they noted that the doctor had submitted a report. They didn't address it. They didn't consider that evidence at all. They didn't say, we've considered this evidence and we've concluded for whatever reason that he doesn't have PTSD. The record reflects that there was a diagnosis and an opinion given by rendered by a psychologist that he has PTSD, that the PTSD contributed to his behavior here. And in fact, he does conclude by saying that many people in law enforcement have similar afflictions. And while he did note it, I did point out that there's a statute in Minnesota that says that law enforcement individuals, 176.011 subdivision 15E, states that PTSD on the part of a law enforcement official is presumed to be work-related. So all of those factors suggest here that the PTSD did exist. The county didn't make that determination that it didn't exist. And if, in fact, that's what the record reflects, as it does, then the question is, what are the consequences of having PTSD here in the record? The consequences from the case law is that a mental affliction, a mental deficiency, a mental defect like that can negate a finding, a determination of willfulness or malicious behavior. The county rests its position on malfeasance on the contention that Sheriff Duncan's behavior was willful or malicious. That's what the county says in its brief, and that's how it supports the county board's determination.
But by doing that, didn't they then at least implicitly reject Dr. Eichenfield's opinion that none of the behaviors had an ulterior motivation or illicit purpose? I mean, they had the emails in front of them threatening harm to her children and family. Why isn't that enough for the county to say, we're going to reject the opinions of Dr. Eichenfield here?
Well, we don't know if they reject him because they didn't say they reject him. They didn't say, we've considered it, we rejected it for the following reasons.
So you'd have no argument if they would have included a specific finding that the doctor's opinion that there was no illicit or ulterior motivation here is rejected because this is what he said in his emails.
Well, I don't know if I'd have no objection, but certainly the record here does not support the county board's determination. They didn't find facts that indicate that there was not PTSD, which the record reflected was the case. If there was, and because Dr. Eichenfield, because the record reflects that there's PTSD, that condition can negate a determination of malfeasance or willfulness. And we've cited a number of cases that indicate that. They're usually cases where their intentional torts are claimed, often arising in an insurance context, and frequently the question is whether there's an obligation to defend or indemnify for an intentional tort. And the case law indicates that if the intentional tort, if the behavior underlying the intentional tort was the product of some kind of mental deficiency or mental disease or mental defect, that negates a determination that the conduct was willful or malicious. That analogy, we think, is apt in this case. There was a determination of PTSD. The county didn't refute or dispute it. The county made no findings that it didn't exist, and therefore the record reflects that Sheriff Duncan was operating under a mental deficiency or mental defect. As a result of that, there cannot be, as a matter of law, any malice or willfulness in his behavior, and that negates the exception for malfeasance or bad faith, and therefore should invoke a duty of defense and indemnification. Thanks.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing. The matters are deemed submitted. Decision will be issued within statutory time frame. This court now will recess while we set up for an ITV hearing.
Again, Diane. Do you want to talk about any of the other